Greetings again, ladies and gents. We're doing another fun filmmaker and actor retrospect here on the show tonight. It is Brent Huff. Welcome.
Well, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Anytime. A documentary filmmaker, also known for his recurring TV roles on Pensacola, Wings of Gold, Shameless, and The Rookie, and his Bruno Mattei Commando films. You might also know him for his guest appearances on The West Wing, Mad Men, and NCIS. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, as an intro, I mean, once again, you've talked before how you got to be really cultured about the film industry at a young age, just doing so many international productions. But, you know, for doing just so many different realms of entertainment, what trait do you think you took away the most just from the fact that you were just off the ground running at just such a young age?
Well, I knew that I wanted to do this back in high school. So the high school that I went to has a really good theater program. In fact, Brad Pitt went to the same he and I went to the same high school. And then I went to the University of Missouri, studied theater, and then came out here to L.A. and went to New York to study acting. And then in the 80s, I started doing all these foreign productions. You know, I did the modeling thing in Milan when I was over there. I got this movie, The Perils of Gwendolyn, and then that.
Right.
All these movies with Bruno Mattei. And so I got to do these kind of low-budget B-action movies literally all over the world. From the I think I did five in the Philippines, South Africa, Germany, everywhere, all over, Argentina. So it was a great experience, and I learned a lot about filmmaking then, like... I learned a lot about what not to do, but I had a good time doing it all. And I had a great group of actors and filmmakers that I had the good fortune to work with.
And since, you know, income and just the various career choices were just plentiful and just steady, you basically at that point, I guess you could say, were just going along for the ride. You know.
It was like back in the 80s, I was just doing one film after another. I thought, oh, this is great. But at a certain point, I thought, you know, these scripts aren't very good, and I wanted to sort of do my own thing. So what happened is that I wrote a play, and I produced a play here in Los Angeles called Actors and Other Animals. And from that play, I thought, well, you know what, if I film this, I could make it into a film. And so I wrote a script called We the People, and I got a buddy of mine, James Brolin, to produce it. Yes. We both acted in it. And from then on, I decided, well, I really want to be a director and writer. And so I was focusing more on that. I had a great time doing that. And so that's sort of what launched me into doing writing, directing, and acting. And so that just opened it up for me that I had all these different avenues where I could get a job in the industry that I love. So it wasn't just, I'm an actor waiting for the phone to ring. I'm writing scripts, I'm directing, doing all sorts. I'm doing voiceovers, I'm doing all sorts of things to keep me in this business. And like I said, to do what I love.
Oh, absolutely. And yeah, I knew about the history of that movie, but I didn't realize that was also based on a play of yours.
Well, it wasn't exactly, let me rephrase that. The play that I wrote was called Actors and Other Animals, which was about six actors / waiters working at Joe Allen's in New York, counting their tips after the doors closed to the restaurant, all talking about why they haven't made it in the film business. So it was totally different than what the movie ended up, which was three couples going to a cabin up in Big Bear, and two bad guys, I'm being one of them, break in and kind of hold them hostage for 90 minutes.
So, yeah.
It all takes place in one room on both, but they're completely different. But it's the play that inspired me that I could do a film.
Oh, totally.
And what happened is at the time, you know, this was before digital, Agfa, which was the third company that would make film negatives. There's Fuji, Kodak, and Agfa. Agfa was going out of business. They gave me 38,000 feet of free film. I went over to the Panavision office. They gave me a first-time filmmaker's package, free cameras. And then I got actors that I knew. We all went up to Big Bear and all got them rooms in the same bed and breakfast. We shot it there. So I did everything I could to save money to make my first film. We shot the film in 13 days. But that's sort of how that happened.
Oh, very neat. And how cool that you can say, hey, you know, I tried all kinds of film.
Yeah, I did. And then I got the money. James Brolin's dentist gave me some money to make it. I put in some of my own money. And an actress from Germany paid for a third of the film. And the good thing about that is we took it to Cannes Film Festival, well, Cannes Market, and we sold it for, and we doubled our money like in the first hour. So I thought, man, this filmmaking is pretty profitable and easy. It wasn't that easy for
No, but I know what you mean.
Yeah. From there, I thought, well, this is easy. Now it's not so easy.
And just from working all, you know, just big and small productions, what notes were you just kind of taking away the most, just aside from just seeing how the various crew members worked and getting your beats as an actor, you know, down to a T?
Yeah, it's, well, I never thought I'd want to direct myself because it's weird being in a scene where you say action and cut and you're in the scene. but so I would have the AD, assistant director, say action, but then I would say cut because you never know what magic is going to happen afterwards. So it's kind of weird to break character in a scene and cut and come back and do it. But, and so a lot of times I did, you know, even though the producers wanted me to act in something, I didn't because I just wanted to concentrate on the directing. But what I learned, I love great set design. I love great lighting. I love great music, the score, all these things that I love, and I'm a very visual person. But I found that you can have all those things, but if you don't have a good story and you don't have good actors, you're dead. But if you have a good story, good actors, and the lighting is not as good as it should be, the sound, the music, all that kind of stuff, you can still have a good film if you have good acting and a good story.
Now, 1,000%.
Yeah, but of course I want it all, but that's what I learned. And then you save a lot of money if you write a script that takes place one night in one location, because not only it's like you don't have company moves going all over the place, the actors are wearing the same wardrobe all the time. Now we have backup in case something rips or they spill something out, but it's one wardrobe throughout the whole film. So that saves money. So if you're looking to make your first film and you don't have a big budget, there's things that you can do to really save money.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And do you ever get recognized just from some of your various roles and B pictures? Or
yeah, I get, well, now mostly I get recognized from The Rookie. I walk down the street, a lot of people will yell out my character's name, Smitty, so I get a lot of that. And then I got cops and firemen come up to me a lot and say, oh, there's a Smitty in our department is what, you know. So that's been kind of fun.
Nice.
Yeah.
And I especially recognize you from just various other films like Oblivion to, you know, The Bad Pack and even Hijack. Oh, Larry Hudson.
You saw those?
Yep.
Oh, man. Yeah. So, well, The Bad Pack I wrote. And I got the, my wife is in it, but I got to hire a bunch of, you know, friends that I knew in that one. So we just actually did, they remastered the Bad Pack, and the co-writer and one of the producers and I just did the audio commentary for that, which was a lot of fun. I hadn't seen the movie in years, so it was
kind of reminisce. Well, and this was back when, you know, everyone was taking a lot of, you know, independent pictures pretty seriously, not knowing where, you know, would they be on TV, Blockbuster, or just, you know, at a festival and then, you know.
Well, yeah, good. At the time, you know, I'd go to Blockbuster all the time and you'd have the Titanic, you know, VHS or DVD right next to the Bad Pack. So it's like, you know, so I would make sure and put the, you know, the Bad Pack close to these big films like that so that at least they would see it and somebody would rent it. But
right.
I miss Blockbuster.
Totally. And, yeah. You know, during college, you know, just like how, you know, it's kind of funny how everyone finds different medium through different avenues and by era. Like if you weren't listening to the radio, then you were listening to whatever records your parents had, and same kind of deal with movies, where it's like, you know, my friends were listening to music for LimeWire and I was going for Rapid Share and just other used DVD stores. And so, yeah, I saw plenty of your movies eventually, like Serbian Scars. Cause it's just like, it's just,
oh, easy to come by. You saw Serbian Scars?
Yeah.
Oh my, yeah, that was hilarious, yeah.
It's
interesting fact, yeah. The guy that produced Serbian Scars, Vladimir Racic, He ran for president in Serbia.
Oh, wow.
He didn't win, but I'm like, yeah, okay. And he's a car salesman in Chicago. So we really? Kind of had a joke on the set. We called it Serbian Cars. But he was a car salesman. I think he might still be in Chicago. He got money together, got Michael Madsen, and, you know, he hired me and made this movie
Costco.
Belgrade. and then, you know, he had big dreams that he said, I'm going to be, you know, I want to be in a movie. I'm going to be an actor. Never acted before. He did that. And then he ran for president of Serbia.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's like, I don't know what is the deal is with actors being presidents of countries. So thinking about Ukraine right now, geez.
Right. Sign of the times.
Yeah. Yeah.
And how do you also feel about just like just seeing, you know, other actors who you worked with and seeing how they've inspired to eventually get behind the camera?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's I have not that many of my friends have went from acting to directing. I've had a lot of friends who are directors, but they've always been directors, or you know. But and then some will say, "I want to do my own documentary." But documentaries are really hard, and you've got to like keep up the interest, and you got to just keep forging through because it takes, you know, like I'd say average for my documentaries, they take 2 years to make. And
totally.
You just never know how the story's going to end. So you can have one, you think you know how a story's going to go, and then you can do one interview and all of a sudden it sets it on its ear and goes a complete different direction. And then with directing, every time I direct a film, I lose a lot of weight because of the stress. And it's like, I'm always doing a lot. I did a movie in Russia where I was in Russia for 4.5 months and I lost 26 pounds. And I don't have 26 pounds to lose. And I looked really scary skinny toward the end where my wife was really worried about me.
Oh, dear.
But I always thought it was an action film. It's sort of like the Fast and the Furious, Moscow style. And the stuntmen in Russia will do anything. And it was like really dangerous. I thought, you know, I'm going to get somebody killed. And it was like, you know, worried. And the food wasn't great. And it was like, but with every film, there's just... And I tell potential directors, you're going to answer at least 500 questions a day. And I'm not even joking. Like people come up to you constantly and ask you, do you like this shade of black or that shade of black? And you can't say, oh, I don't care. You go, no, I like this shade of black, please. And then they'll say, why? Because it's crushing the black. What, you know, come up with something.
It looks extravagant. Go with
exactly.
It.
What's the color? Does it go with the color palette? And then the makeup artist would say, no, it doesn't, you know, it's like, it just snowballs. And that's why with the bigger productions I've been on, they send somebody to actually keep an eye on the director at all times. Oh, he's going to the restroom, he's doing this, that, because you can't go anywhere without answering the question. As soon as you say cut, people come up to you, ask you, you know, questions. And then I'm always thinking as an actor, when I talk to directors, they're not really giving me much time or whatever. Now as a director, I know that I'm more sympathetic to directors because they've got a lot of fires to put out.
Right. They got any oh shit look on their face, you know, that just translates to the crew as, oh, this is not good. This movie probably won't get done. You know?
Well, you got to come to the set because you arrive to the set. There's already people there, transport people, everybody's setting up. And you can't go, oh, what do we do? You got to come in and go, all right, here's what I want. Bah, 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 because you lose the respect of the crew and the mm-hmm. actors if you don't sort of take control. Now, I'm very collaborative. If somebody comes up with a good idea, and I don't care if it's somebody in craft services comes up with the idea, a good idea is a good idea. I've got no ego about it, and we go with it. And then, you know, with the actors, you know, I like, because I am an actor, I love working with actors and sort of coming up with, you know, the motivation, like certain characters do certain things. And that's what I really love about the
A 1,000%.
Yeah.
And when developing your movies, what formulas do you think you take from the most that you just were always loosely inspired by the most?
Well, let's see. I'm kind of all over the place. But in 1994 is when I did We the People. It was my first movie that I wrote and directed. Of course, I thought it was brilliant and all this kind of, you know, because it was in some film festivals and stuff. And then that's when Pulp Fiction came out. I would see other movies, I go, my movie's as good as that, my movie's as good as that. And I saw Pulp Fiction, I go, oh, it's not, anywhere close to being that good. So Pulp Fiction sort of inspired me to think outside the box. But he, you know, it wasn't the non-linear thing. It was just, I've seen Pulp Fiction a million times because I just think it's so brilliant. But that probably inspired me more than anything with the writing and directing.
1,000%. Okay, cool. And I mean,
and Sam Raimi too. Sam Raimi, Evil Dead 2, and The Quick and the Dead. Some of the camera angles and stuff. You've seen Evil Dead 2, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, I mean that the low tech stuff that they did to come up with these creative shots was amazing.
1,000%.
Yeah.
And speaking of which, you know, there's just so many people now that we've done it in a digital age, and they just seem to want to be snobby about, oh, well, you know, you just filmed it for this budget and that budget. So how do you just remind people to just be considerate and just not be a jerk? You know, it's just like,
online.
Well, or just in general, like when they're seeing a movie and you're realizing they're just acting like a movie is better or less than because of whatever budget. And it's like, well, you wouldn't have known otherwise until you looked it up, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, why you don't put your budget like an IMDb, you know, people, what'd you spend on this? Well, I don't really want to say that, you know, producers won't let me say, cause they're going to think, well, it's not any good if you didn't spend a lot of money. Last night was the Academy Awards, and I took, cause as being a Screen Actors Guild, you know, on the nominating committee, I get all the movies. So I've seen them. And I told everybody, I said, Coda is by far my favorite movie. Feel good movie. And it's a small movie. We're talking about small scale. It's a small movie, but a crowd pleaser. And the performances, the girl who was the lead to the film, she didn't get nominated, but she was amazing. I think she was 19 years old when she did it. I think she's British. So she did an American accent. She learned how to sign. She learned how to sing. She learned how to, on a fishing boat, what to do and still be a great actress. I mean, that takes a lot, and she deserves a lot of credit.
Totally.
Yeah.
And more or less, just since you've been on both sides of the camera, do you also believe that, you know, just patience and just pacing yourself is just one of many ways to just kind of get in the right mood and setting?
When I'm on the set?
Yeah, or what are you in front of or behind?
Well, the thing is, when I'm, and this is true, I always have a limited budget. I've had a few movies where I've had a big budget, but most of them are limited budget where I have an 18-day shoot. And I'm very ambitious because I want it to look way bigger than the budget I have. So I have these exterior shots, and and I've got a pretty big shot list every day. So from the moment I arrive, I'm behind, if that makes sense.
Okay.
You know, there's a joke like for first-time filmmakers, the first half of the day is Gone with the Wind, and the second half of the day is Dukes of Hazzard. Because you run out of time, and you're doing all this. And so now I know from minute one, if I have the shot, I have to move on, because something will suffer at the end of the day. I don't have the money to come back to that location. And so a lot of actors, and I loved, you know, when actors want an extra take and stuff, and I'll do what I can to accommodate that. But at a certain point, I have to move on. And with low budget films, you don't get all the coverage that you want. Like when I'm shooting The Rookie, I'll have scenes where I have five cameras looking at me. I'm like, man, I wish I had that luxury when I'm directing an independent film, but I don't.
Totally understood. Yeah. And so, you know, you bring a shot list, you think of how many different ways you're going to shoot different things. And now it just seems like even just other independent movies are just kind of suffering just because no one's making use of any of their time or material that they got available to them.
Well, I always shoot my master first. So I shoot the master first, and then in case the camera breaks or something happens, I've got the scene. I did a film as an actor with John Mellencamp called Falling from Grace that Larry McMurtry wrote.
Yes.
And the whole thing, like the last picture show, it's all masters. So there's not cover, you know, close up and coverage. And that saves you a lot of time. So I do my master first, so if anything happens, I've got the shot, and so I don't have to come back, you know, tell the investors I got to pay for coming back to that location. But then I can come in for coverage, and if I'm getting everything's working, maybe I'll get a couple of extra shots that I have in the back of my head that I'd love to have.
Nice. And do you just have any other advice for just people getting into it? I mean, just other than, you know, reminding others on how to make sure that someone is just for real, just reliable and serious.
These days now, there is no excuse not to be making your own content. You can do it with your iPhone. I wish when I was a young actor, I had this opportunity. So I hang out with a lot of, you know, just because I'm in the business, I hang out with a lot of people in the industry here, a lot of actors, writers, directors, all the costumers, makeup people, and I can get everybody together. I can call 10 people together, actors and makeup, wardrobe, and go, let's make a movie on my phone, a 10-minute short, and we'll do this on weekends. I don't want to take any money off the table, so you can do it on your free time, and we'll shoot this, and we'll light it well, and we'll have good sound, and everybody owns a piece of this, so we're all part owners of this short film, and we're going to send it to film festivals. And so you as actors, you're going to have an entree look for your reel. You same with the wardrobe, same with makeup. I worked in this film. So there's no excuse not to these days. It's just, you know, put it in the sweat equity.
1,000%.
When I was younger, you know, I bought my first camcorder. It was the size of a suitcase, you know, and I think I paid $1,100 at Costco for it, but it was tape and it looked bad. But, you know, I started making my own films then, and you learn, you know, like, you know, composition of a shot and what doesn't work and what does work. But today with the, you know, you shoot with your iPhone in 4K, it looks great. So, there's no excuse not to, but it's like, very few actually will go ahead and do it. So I would rather have the guy who gets his mom to make the costumes and a friend of his to do the wardrobe or to do the makeup and another actor friends than somebody who just pays, you know, $100,000 a year to go to AFI and then put in the work. So
1,000%.
That's just me. It's probably because I didn't have $100,000 to go to AFI. And I would have loved to have gone to AFI.
Totally. And so more or less, do you just think now the industry's just changing so much to where everyone's got to just be a little more concerned about, you know, distribution angles, just always have that figured out before you shoot a single frame?
I'm just going through with my documentary, The Jackie Stiles Story, which is a very, I'm not just saying it's because of my film, but it's a very inspirational story. Jackie Stiles, many consider the greatest female college basketball player of all time. She's an undersized girl that went from a tiny Kansas town who had these big dreams of being the greatest basketball player, and then she accomplished it. She set the all-time NCAA scoring record. I mean, it's like female empowerment. It's got all the things to make a good, great story right now. And I'm shopping for distribution. I finally got distribution, but I'm shopping around and I can't get people to even watch the film. You know, I send them the synopsis. The trailer is really good. They'll say, oh, it looks fantastic. But the go-to line now for distributors is it's too small.
We'll return after these messages.
Do you ever find yourself thinking about who would win in a fight between Goku and Superman? Hi, I'm James Gavsey, and on the Who Would Win show, me and my co-host Ray ignore anything important happening in the outside world and debate fictional battles between characters from comics, movies, and video games.
We got a new show every week, and almost always am I the winner.
Yeah, not true, Ray.
In the past, we've discussed such matches as Captain America versus Darth Vader, Solid Snake versus the Iron Giant, classic matchups like RoboCop versus Terminator, and even the Muppets versus Sesame Street.
That one was crazy. So if you're a fan of geek culture and love a spirited debate, check out the Who Would Win show wherever you get your podcasts, or check us out at whowouldwinshow.com.
We let things pile up in the DVR. We add them to our queues. We wait for the DVDs and Blu-rays. we time shift. The Time Shifters podcast. Sci-fi, horror, fantasy, superheroes, comedy, action, film, television, maybe some not-so-current events. Find us on iTunes or at timeshifterspodcast.com.
Cool thing about Blind Knowledge is we are in multiple countries. We are worldwide, all across the globe. We are in the US, we are in the UK, we are in Canada, Germany, India, Japan, we're in Australia, y'all. BlindKnowledge.com. Now back to the feature presentation.
Dragon Ball Z, One Piece, Naruto, all things that we love, all manga that were originally published in the legendary magazine Weekly Shonen Jump.
But not every series can run for 300 chapters and have a hit anime. This is David.
This is Jordan.
We're the hosts of Shonen Flop. Each episode we look at manga that ran in Jump that didn't quite make it.
We discuss what it did wrong, what it did right, how the series could have turned itself around, and ultimately, was it a flop or not?
Run all your favorite podcast apps, and you can find us at shonenflop.com.
Keep on flopping, floppers.
And then I'll ask, well, what do you mean it's too small? The names in the film aren't big enough, the production value. I can't put my finger on it, it's just too small. So that's sort of what, you know, I'm getting. And I also did a kids movie with Jake Paul, who's a big YouTube star, and it's a kids.
I saw that. Was on your resume there, you were talking about it.
Yeah, it's called The Genie's Tale, and it's a cute kids movie, very Disney-like, and the people who produced it are a foreign sales distributor. Even though they've been in the business for a long time, they're even having problems getting distributors here to look at it. Now, if they look at it and pass, that's one thing, but not to even look at it. And you think, well, the people are looking for content out there, but it's still tough. And I guess what I'm not understanding, there's so many films out there that are really terrible that it hurts the ones that, you know, you do make that are good, because people, like, you know, some are really bad. I have to admit.
Totally. And do you think it's just, at that point, it's just easier to just self-distribute on Tubi or Amazon Prime?
Well, what I did, I have a movie called Chasing Beauty about the modeling industry that was on, Netflix. It was on Netflix. What else was it on? Logo TV. I don't know if you know what Logo is.
Yes.
But anyway, it was, did really well. It was the number one documentary on iTunes for almost a month. Then the contract ran up with Netflix, so I could self-distribute. And at the time, this was only a couple years ago, I was able to put it on Amazon Prime myself. And I thought, if nothing else, I'll always put all my documentaries on Amazon Prime myself. Well, now they've made it where you can't do that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they've changed the rules on that. Now, you can do Tubi still, but they've changed it with Amazon Prime, unfortunately.
Gotcha. And I think it's just because they were just getting just so many movies where they just saw people were just skipping through it, or they couldn't hear anything. The sound was bad, even though the digital.
Well, Cam, that's what happens a lot. I'll see a movie and I'll say, this movie is really low budget and terrible, but why is it? And then you think, because, oh, it's the sound.
Mm-hmm.
The sound is so bad. It's
the shots are there, the actors look intense, but yet if there's not dead space, then there's just something.
Right. Yeah. In fact, I've done a lot of Zoom interviews. You're the only one that's asked for room tone. So that's a good on you.
Thank you. The last thing I want to do is, you know, be a jerk and just, you know, make myself just, you know, have an engaging interview and everyone's like, well, I can't hear what's really going on. So, you know, and I think, you know, this, you know, just if it's too easy, then it probably is. It's just so, you know, there's always something extra someone can be doing and making sure and enhancing whatever experience they're in.
Oh, I just did a film with where it was just like, as an actor, I'm like, whoa. This is, but I don't want to say anything, but it's like, yeah.
All good. And that's what's hard too. I mean, so whenever, you know, you hear people talking smack about each other, just like working with each other. And it's like, no, keep that private. And I'm the same way. I saw some podcasters bickering with each other. And it's like, no, that it's a small world, even more so there. So don't bite each other's, faces off, guys. Let's.
Oh, I know. Well, you get a lot of criticism from people who've never done it. Yeah. It's not as easy. It's hard to make a good movie. You know, you have good intentions, you think you got a good script, and all this, you put everything together and it should work, and for some reason it doesn't. One of my favorite filmmakers is David Fincher. If David Fincher directs something, I'm going to go see it. It's, because I know it's going to be good. But he said in an interview that he doesn't criticize other filmmakers because he knows how hard it is. And this guy's one of the best. He would have room to criticize people who don't, don't have the talent to put in the work, but it's a hard thing to do. And I've met a lot of filmmakers that are really crazy smart and they can talk a good game with film. They can break down. I go, man, I wish I knew as much about cinema as they did. I wish I knew as much about storytelling as they did. And then they'll make a film and it's just not good. So I don't know. There's an X factor in there.
Oh, 1,000%.
Yeah. The great thing about this business is you continue to learn, and people ask me about, what's going on in my life now, I go, listen, I'm getting better. So I've been doing this for decades, but I'm getting better.
Oh, totally. I was working with a few different indie talents, and there were some I had to just, manually just kind of cut off just without, unfriending them or anything. It was just kind of one of those, we're not on the same page.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was with some who were basically getting a bunch of people and they were giving them a credit, but they were basically cutting out all their scenes just because they weren't in it. And I'm like, oh, okay, no, that does not fly.
Oh, yeah. No, that's not good. Yeah.
And then we did have some other cinematographers kind of like, they were like, be free of them. And all of them were like arguing with each other on what was the superior camera. I'm like, it's way,
Oh, really? About the camera? They're going, no, the Mini is so much better than the Red.
It was even just more just casual, like Nikon versus Canon. And it's just like, so whatever you guys agree to go with, you go with. And have you ever had to even remind other peers about that, to where it's just like, yeah, it's time to.
I say it's not about the camera. It's about who's behind the camera,
Mm-hmm.
And so, like I said, you can make a good film with it. Did you see the movie Tangerine?
What, one of your recent movies?
No, I'm not. That's a movie that the guy who directed.
Oh, the 2013 war movie?
No, it's about sort of male street hustlers in L.A. It's called Tangerine. He shot the whole thing on his iPhone. And it's amazing. It's really good. I want to say it's called The Florida Project. I forgot this director's name, which is a shame because I'm really impressed with him. But he did it with the iPhone. Soderbergh made it. What a series with the iPhone.
Yeah. That and On Sane was pretty good.
Yeah. So if it's good enough for Soderbergh, yeah.
I was using the Filmic Pro app and I was like, okay, so all we need is just extra people doing the sound. And
I told you how stressful the directing is, and I lose all this weight. Can you imagine, like, Soderbergh has all the stress of being the director, and then also he's also going to be the camera operator. And yeah. Like, I don't know how he does it. Yeah.
Oh, totally. And have you had to kind of sometimes compromise some of those rules just because, Directors Guild and Actors Guild can be a little critical one?
Yeah. It's like with, it's like you have a certain amount of time to do things with the guild, especially if you're working with kids. I just did a movie with kids and a dog. Yeah. So, you got the teacher on set, you got dogs, you got, young kids that I would constantly have to say, all right, quit dancing, let's do the scene, then you guys can start dancing again. It's not a dancing movie.
Kind of movie.
Yeah, but it was really like wrangling cats.
That's a good way to put it, because, it seems like many will just kind of assume, I think that's what it is, really. I think you nailed it. I think there are many who come into the industry. That's why we have sometimes a good experience with someone. We meet them in one set. They're wonderful. Another set that they're not 100%. And it can be just, sometimes they just think this is an invitation to be on a playground. And it's like, no, this is still a work, you know, environment.
Yeah, we have. And time, it's like the clock is on turbo. It goes really fast. And so if you don't have, you keep moving, and you really need a good AD, assistant director, that can control the set, but is respectful to everybody in their jobs, but they respect him or her and keep it moving. The great thing about this, I did a movie in Kansas City, and I'm from Missouri, and we had a big scene, a wedding scene. And I called a lot of my friends that went to college, and they, you know, were kind of asking me about the movie business. I said, well, you want to come be an extra? So they all got there like at 4:30 in the morning in a big line to go to the costume trailer, and they got suits, and then the girls, women had like, you know, dresses for the wedding. And we shot all day. So they're standing up all day at this wedding and dancing and all this kind of stuff. And I go, these, and they would all come up to me, you mean we spent all this time, it's going to be 5 seconds on film? I go, yeah. So I thought at the end of the day, they're all going to hate me and go, thanks, you know, thanks for nothing. They all came up to me and said, now we know why you love this business. They had a great time because it's a community that comes together, and we're all trying to make a great film. And from the extras to the actors to the crew to the everybody is trying to do something, to tell this story, and we're all coming together and we're a team. And that's what I love about it.
Oh, totally. And do you think that's also another tough predicament? Because like, I would even have to explain to friends and family, I'm like, I'm going to be here all night. I'm going to get here at like home at 4 a.m. Oh, why does it take that long? Why can't you text me? I'm like, because all phones have to be off, yada, yada. Have you ever had to do that?
And you're exhausted. And the last thing, and I'm the worst at this. I've got a little bit of the bug. I'm ADD. So I drive my wife insane. But so I just focus on one thing. And when people like actors try to talk to me on the set when I'm directing, I hear them. I try not to be rude, this, that, and that. But my mind is a million on the next shot or whatever. So I know I'm not giving them the attention that I should. But you've got to focus on what you're doing. And maybe that's the ADD in me that just it's razor focused on one thing. So I apologize to people if I'm rude. I don't mean to be. I'm nice about it. I'm not that guy, but it's like I'm just sort of, you know, my mind's somewhere else.
The truth wins out.
Yeah.
Who are some other talents that, you know, regardless of budget or who's running the show, that you still are on your list of people to collaborate with?
Who are some of the talents that I'd like to collaborate with?
Yeah, just realistically, you just know it could happen. It just is a matter of scheduling.
Well, I would love if David Fincher gave me a call or Quentin Tarantino gave me a call and wanted me to be an actor in one of their movies. It's interesting. In season one of The Rookie, I was in one episode. I had two quick scenes with Nathan Fillion, and I really like Nathan a lot. And when I did this scene, and I just come off of a small arc of doing Shameless,
yeah,
which William H. Macy directed, which I thought was a great experience. And so I was doing The Rookie, and I thought, man, it'd be great if they'd have me back. I had no, because my, like it was a nothing part. And I'm in my fourth season now doing The Rookie, and the character has changed so much from when I started. When I started, I just thought I was the seasoned, grizzled cop that hates rookies, and I'm tough on rookies. I'm sort of the you know, the badass cop, which I played a lot of. But then they started giving me these hilarious lines to say. So now my character, Smitty, is kind of the goofball comic relief of the show, and I'm loving it. And I love going to work every day on The Rookie, and it's just been a great experience. And who knew that this would ever happen? It was one of those things when you're in this business, like, you know, you're looking for breaks, and that was one. And I've had breaks in the past. I've had tons of disappointments in the past. the thing with this business is you get told no a lot. It's the rejection. And, you know, I've just been sort of a warrior, keep doing it. And there's not a lot, because I started at a very young age. And there's still a few of us that I knew back in my early 20s that are around. But unless they hit big, most of them have quit the business.
Interesting. And when you were even just getting into it, did you see how kind of, how much fun it could be to just kind of see, you know, non-film peers' reaction versus, you know, fellow acting pals' reactions, and how, you know, it's such a different reaction that you're trying to gauge. You want a bit of both, and it's hard to please both crowds.
Well, it's my first movie was a basketball movie. I played basketball in college. And so I came out to L.A. and they were casting this movie called Coach with Kathy Lee Crosby and Michael Biehn were in it.
Nice.
And so I came in the audition. This is so stupid, but I could spin a basketball on my finger. So I go into the audition, spin a basketball on my finger. And they're like, that's amazing. And anyway, I got the role. And it was a bunch of guys playing basketball, and, you know, and it's a high school basketball team with a female coach. And that was sort of the, you know, the story. Anyway, loved all the actors I worked with, including Michael Biehn. And we'd shoot basketball, we'd play basketball games. They'd go, oh, Brent and Michael, you got to go shoot this scene real quick. We shoot the scene, then we'd come back and play basketball. And I was very natural because we're all kind of goofing around. And I thought, this is easy, you know. They said acting's tough. This is like my second audition, and I'm one of the leads to this film. And then I didn't get another role for a year and a half. So that was like, interesting.
Right?
And yeah.
But at least you got the experience early on. It's like, this is an unpredictable thing. You know, you always got to keep busy, you know, in between the calls.
Always. And that's what, you know, you can always write scripts, and you know, so you can stay busy that way. Because it's hard to stay busy. You know, you can go to the gym and get a bunch of headshots made, and you can get do showcases and do equity waiver plays. You know, one of my things when I wrote the play Actors and Other Animals, that there were like 400 equity waiver plays a year in Los Angeles. An equity waiver is theaters that are less than 99 seats.
Yes.
So if you really love the theater and you want to go to the theater every single day in the year, you still wouldn't see them all. So that's how many there were. So you'd have to beg your friends to come watch you in these equity waiver plays, but they would charge, you know, the audience like $12. And so these friends would come and pay $12 because you have to charge to kind of pay for the theater. And it was painful, I'm sure, for these the audience, my friends that would come watch me in all these plays do it. But it was, and there would be a lot of times there would be more people in the cast than there were in the play. More people in the cast than were in the audience.
But that's so true.
You're paying your dues.
And you're hoping it's someone else besides the local town critic who's required to, you know, review 5 different plays a month.
Oh, I've got a crazy story. So there was a paper, an industry paper called The Drama Log. It's not around anymore, but at the time, The Drama Log
sounds dramatic.
Yeah, but they'd have the casting and all this kind of stuff. So we got The Drama Log to come review the play that I wrote, Actors and Other Animals. Okay, so I knew, I had my wife actually sit next to the critic because we knew who he was, and make sure that she laughed and stuff in the play. So then the reviews came out, and I was at a newsstand on Fairfax Boulevard Avenue in West Hollywood, and they bring in The Drama Log's reviews. And so I'm reading it, and it just panned the play. It was just horrible, horrible, horrible. I'm like, oh my God, I put so much into this. I put my bad review down on the seat. I drove out, and all these kids that Fairfax High is right there, they throw eggs at my car. So I got my scathing review and the eggs dripping from my car driving in Hollywood. I'm like, is it getting worse than this? That's some of the stuff that you go through.
It's not the end of the world, and you don't know if it's just someone who is reviewing it but not into theater or expects it to be on the quality of a movie. You don't know.
Oh, yeah.
I knew some people. Some of them were snobs, but some of them all had the same story in that there was this one local Dallas critic, and basically he would I don't know how anyone even does a complete review when you got to be very detailed with a play, but he would leave after the first 20 minutes. He got that bored. It was just like, they should do some quality control on some of these critics. It's like, you can't, if you got to sit for the whole 3 hour duration, you got to do that. No fair leaving after 20 minutes and saying, I know.
Well, out here at the American Film Market, you know, they come out to Santa Monica every year, usually in November, I think it is. And so there's all these independent films and they're looking for, you know, for foreign buyers. And so you pay to have your movie screened in the Santa Monica Promenade. There's a bunch of theaters there. And
nice. We have
buyers come in literally for 5 minutes and walk out. And
they'll just got to get their attention right then and there.
Or they'll say yes, which is crazy. They'll see that, you know, the production value looks pretty good and it's the names. Oh, Eric Roberts and Michael Madsen are in this. Okay, I can sell this into, you know, Spain.
Right. Some of them are looking for a certain quality and some of them are just like, it's just got to have something that in some capacity and you don't know until you sign the papers, like you say.
Yeah. And it's like when you go to the Cannes Film Festival, there's the Cannes Film Festival and these great art house movies and the Palais and everybody, all the paparazzi. And then right next door is the Film Market, where it's like the low budget, kind of a flea market for low budget movies where every poster is three heads and a gun. You've seen those, right?
Yeah, discount. The one I'm really sick of now is like the free-to-use poster art, but now everyone's using it. And same thing with like how everyone was using Kevin MacLeod's music. Great music composer, really makes everyone's movie sound professional. But if you use the exact same tune in like five different movies, it gets old fast. But there, Olivier Gruner and some of these other kickboxing martial arts guys who embrace festivals and the direct-to-video market would use the same stock photos of helicopters and a SWAT team, and I was like, but they're not even in the movie, come on.
Happens to me all the time. I did a movie, Cat City, which is a film noir thriller that takes place in Palm Springs with Julian Sands and Rebecca Pidgeon. Mm-hmm. And the poster, in fact, I'm looking at it right there, is a very cool art house poster. For AFM, they've got Vegas in the background, they've got an exploding car, and Rebecca Pidgeon looks like, I can't think of the actress, but she's got a gun. None of this is in the movie. And it's, she looked like Megan Fox in the poster. And then I did a movie, a dark comedy called 100 Mile Rule with Maria Bello.
Yeah.
It's a hilarious dark movie.
I think it came on Spike TV one time, believe it or not. And I kept getting it mixed up because it had such a similar cover to Still, the Stephen Dorff, Natasha Henstridge thriller.
And Gone in 60 Seconds.
And that, yeah, they're all taken from that. The Fast and Furious kind of logo back in the day. And it was...
And if you were to see the trailer, you would think it's an action movie.
Mm-hmm.
Could not be further from the truth. I'm like, and they keep saying, I go, who buys these movies? They said, oh, I love it in the foreign market. Well, because I do these films all over the world, when I'm in these other countries, like Romania and Serbia, and I don't see those movies out there. But they say that they sell them for, and I don't get it. But
totally. Well, and you just named some great actors there. Were a lot of the investors people you were able to work closely with and able to oblige some of your requests saying, hey, I've always wanted to work with so-and-so. Are they available? Were you able to pick any brains?
I said, well, go for somebody. Like Maria Bello. I really wanted Maria Bello because I'd met her. She was actually, she was dating a friend of mine at the time. And I met her and I really liked her and she was fabulous in the movie. But so sometimes I'll go for it. But what I've, because I'm always looking for investors in the movie. And so let's face it, you know, investing in movies is not a sure thing. Like some people will say, I just want to make sure I don't lose any money. Can you guarantee that I'm not going to lose any money? I go, no, I can't guarantee you that. How much could I lose? I'm like, all of it.
You know, so, right.
Yeah. But what I'm finding for investors is there's an emotional tie to the movie. Now, it could be that their son wants to be one of the stars of the film. It could be that they wrote it. It could be that it's because it's a story about them. Or it could be that they want to be on the set and take pictures with movie stars. But there's something other than it's a money-making thing. There's an emotional tie to get people to part with their money at this level. And so I tell potential investors that this movie will look really professional. I will work really hard at it. I'll show you my other work. It's going to look as good as these. Whether it translates into a great movie or not, I don't know. I think it will, or I wouldn't be doing it. But that's what I tell them. And I've never had any complaints on that. But the emotion is what triggers a lot of people to, you know, want to get in this business.
Absolutely. And don't you find it even funnier how when you become somewhat recognizable, people will get used to seeing you in different kind of formats, like what you say, like a less seen cult actors in a rare TV commercial. And
yeah.
That's how I was with your appearance on Westman. Like, hey, there's Brent Hoffman, what's his name? Yeah, and all those Jim Wynorski action films.
So you know all the guys, like Fred Olin Ray, you know who Fred is? Sure, and Worth Keeter and all this, you know.
There are so many movies of different kinds and quality, and they, you know, it's just so funny how the various stories they talk about.
Well, have you interviewed, like, Fred?
I might have to get Fred on. I know Jim doesn't do interviews anymore unless they're paid, and they've been at so many different conventions. And
yeah, well, they do the comic book stuff, right? Because I saw him and stuff. But if you can get Fred's hilarious. Fred's great.
Oh, totally. Did he ever tell you one of his many stories about working with Peter Cushing?
No.
In, like, the Amazons, and Cushing was, like, a trooper. He had just, like, broken his two front teeth or something like that. And Fred, it was one of his first gigs. I think it was Shockwaves was the movie. It was, like, this less seen, gothic-y kind of zombie film. And Fred's photographer. Yeah.
Oh, he was before he was directed. He was okay.
Yeah, 77.
My first film with Fred, it was called Jade Jungle at the time, but they changed it to Armed Response. And I played David Carradine's brother, and my dad was Lee Van Cleef, who I'm like, oh my God, the good, bad, and the ugly. So my first scene is with those two, and I'm like, could this get any better?
Right, and you got to work with Carradine again years later. You know, so.
Oh, yeah, I directed Carradine in one of his last films in Russia. And he was a character, Carradine. But Lee Van Cleef was too. I ran into Lee Van Cleef in Manila in the Philippines. There at the time in the 80s, I'd stay at this place, the International Hotel in Manila, and you'd run into friends of yours all the time, and they're all doing the same kind of movie. Oh, you playing a Vietnam War vet who's going back to, you know, find his buddies? Oh, yeah, same thing, you know.
I'm doing a Die Hard takeover film here. I'm doing a Rambo clone here. I'm doing a Commando cash in here.
One of the Bruno Mattei movies, I think it's not Born to Fight. So the director, the writer says, it's very similar to Rambo 2. And I'm reading it. I go, it's exactly Rambo 2.
Right.
Without the budget. But yeah. But, you know, the movies were what they were. But I had a great time in the Philippines, and the Filipino people are great. And it's like, I got really sick one time. I don't know if you have a story, but I was doing, did you see Strike Commando 2 by chance?
Oh, of course.
Okay, so you remember there's a scene where I'm in a pool, a fight in a pool?
I think so, yes.
I'm running from you know, with Richard Harris. Anyway, I go into this pool, and I got this fight scene, and I jump in the pool, and I'm like, because I was doing all my own stunts, and I loved it. And so that night, we go back. We're staying at this place called Los Baños, which I think means the toilet, but it's a little town.
Exactly, yeah.
I'm eating with the crew and everybody, and all of a sudden, I'm like, I don't feel good. And then all of a sudden, I'm like shaking. I'm really sick, and they feel me. I'm like hot. I'm sweaty. They rushed me to a hospital.
That's right. You didn't talk about that.
In the jungle. And I'm laying there, and I've got IVs in, and Bruno Mattei's in the room, and Mary Steven, who's this female star. And there's lizards going up and down the wall, and the sheets are torn in this bed. And I go, oh, my God, I'm going to die here in the Philippines. I mean, I'm like, you know. And so the next day, I'm really weak. And so the doctor comes in, and he goes, He said, are you married? And I go, no. He goes, why aren't you married? I go, I don't know. I'm just not married. And an hour later, he brings in both of his daughters.
That's right. And you're like.
And introduces me to them. And then that night, they had a band play literally outside my window. And I knew like three songs, but one was La Bamba, you know, the song La Bamba. And I must have played it 20 times. It was like torture. But I survived.
Yeah.
It was crazy.
And have you ever been tempted to just kind of just make a random like photo book and just, is like my work in independent film.
Oh, I've got a whole box of stuff that is like, oh my God, remember this? Remember, you know, kind of thing. Yeah. So
maybe collaborate with a few other, you know, B movie and indie guys. Who's like, yeah, let's inspire this generation.
Well, that's how the idea for the Bad Pack came up, because I knew guys like Michael Dudikoff. Michael Dudikoff and I were models together. All right. Yeah, so we were both modeling, and then when I did The Perils of Gwendolyn in Paris, he was dating Tawny Catane. So they would talk on the phone all night, and the phone bills was like crazy. And so Michael and I were friends, and he was dating Tawny, and then he says, oh yeah, I'm doing a film called Bachelor Party. And oh, that's great. And at the time, Bachelor Party starred Paul Reiser and Kelly McGillis. They ended up letting those two go, and they hired Tom Hanks and Tawny Catane, you know.
Yeah, and you were in her biography special.
Right. Oh, you saw that. Well, Michael at the time was doing like, he was kind of playing the dumb surfer guy, and then all of a sudden he becomes the American Ninja. Mm-hmm. So now he's a serious guy. But anyway, so the Bad Pack, I go, I know all these, you know, B-movie action stars, and that's what the Bad Pack was going to be.
You got Robert Davi, Ralph Moeller, years Ralph before Mueller. Gladiator.
Yeah.
All the Conan show.
Yeah.
Are there any others that you're just tempted to work with that just the chance hasn't presented itself, like Dolph Lundgren, Van Damme, or even...
Haven't worked with them. You know, I got Roddy Piper was in Bad Pack, and great guy.
Working with him on another movie, too, yeah.
That come with Tawny Catane. So it's all kind of like this small group. But a lot of people, like Vernon Wells, he was in the Bad Pack. He still does all these kind of movies. If you look at Vernon's IMDb page, it's probably this long.
The billionth take on, you know, being famous for Mad Max 2 and Commando.
I worked with Michael Madsen in 2007. I bet... No exaggeration, he's done over 100 films since then.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. I'm friends with another guy. Well, I mean, you worked with him on that very movie, Joe Estevez. He's like, yeah.
Joe's Michael, a great guy.
He is a wonderful dude. And same kind of deal, kind of like Don Swayze. He had that whole logic. He's like, hey, it's okay if I'm mistaken for the better known famous family member. It's a business, and just have fun with it. And, you know, give it your all, regardless of the production. And yeah, he just talked about it. He's like, yeah, Madsen, he's got five kids. So whatever happens, happens.
Well, the movie that I did with Madsen, Joe Estevez was in it, over in Serbia.
Yep.
Did Joe tell you the story about Apocalypse Now, him coming out of the water?
Yeah. He has a wonderful book called Wiping Off the Sheen, and it's a hysterical read.
Well, when I worked with him, I said, oh, I did the West Wing. He goes, oh, so you're in the West Wing. I still haven't been asked to be in the West Wing. I go, really? So I go, doesn't Martin Sheen have a brother as the president? That'd be perfect.
Totally. He since then, I think he mellowed out a bit. The comedians Tim and Eric, you know, who worked with Will Ferrell and had Joe on a bunch of their various Adult Swim shows, and had him playing a presidential equivalent, just kind of spoofing his famous brother's role.
Oh, I know. Yeah, yeah. And, with the brothers, I know for voiceover, Lauren Dreyfus, who's Richard Dreyfus's brother,
oh,
sounds exactly like him. So if you don't have the money, you know, I don't know if he's still doing voice. I mean, those are years ago. I'm like, yeah, we get it. Maybe we get Lauren.
And there's plenty of other people I've noticed who that's kind of their deal is like they do additional dialogue recording, ADR for short, and as a result, they probably will often voice that actor's famous character in like video games or what have you. It's a good way to be a side business, even if you're just known for just, you know, being the backup.
Oh, yeah. And I've been asked to do voice matches a lot. I even a Christopher Walken one, which I butchered, but they do it all the time. And if you can really mimic somebody that works, you know, and big famous actors, and you're like, well, why would they be okay with some other people voicing them? But maybe they're just so busy.
Right. They didn't have time to come into the studio.
Yeah. Yeah.
Something goofed up. Well, here's another pal, and I'm surprised I haven't seen him dub as many movies, and I know you worked with him on that same Carradine film, Andrew Devoff. I'm friends with his social media coordinator.
Yeah. Andrew worked, did I just do one movie? I did, you know, Treasure Raiders with him in Russia, and Andrew speaks Russian.
Yeah, which is part Venezuelan, part Russian.
Kind of cool. Anyway, a good friend of mine has a house in Lake Arrowhead, up in the mountains here outside of L.A., and she goes, you might know my neighbor. He's an actor. I go, what's his name? Andrew Devoff. So he's up in Lake Arrowhead. I'm jealous.
Right.
But when I saw Andrew before I knew him in another 48 hours, he was so good.
I have the time, other pals of mine who knew him just from stuff like Wishmaster, I would have to tell them, you've seen him more than you realize. And you're like, remember the guy who Harrison Ford fights in the airplane? That's him. You know, it's just,
yeah. And he's got a commercial out right now that runs all the time. I forgot what it's for, but where he's with his son. But
oh, really?
Yeah.
I'll have to keep an eye out.
Yeah.
Is it just like a cell phone ad?
I forgot what it's for, but he's got a son, and I forgot what it's for. And that's probably not good, but you know, right away, you know, it's Andrew.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, when you're just now that you've gone through exploring what you want to with documentary film, are there any other topics that you think, you know, sooner or later you're definitely going to explore
with the documentaries?
Yeah, because you've really embraced that. You've done fashion, you've done, again, like,
yeah, I've done fat, yeah. There was you know what furries are, who furries are? The people dress up like animals, and there's these conventions and stuff.
Okay, and I heard of that, and for some
and sort of a sexual element to it. Anyway, there was a threesome, furry threesome, and one of them murdered another one, and they called it the Fullerton Furry Murders. And I'm thinking, if nothing else, the title is great for that, but I'm thinking, I don't know how big of an interest that would be, but that, I found that fascinating.
And you just think it would be, you know,
just bizarre, like, it's, you know, just how bizarre it is. But I think this last movie I did with Jackie Stiles, it was so uplifting. I just had a screening, and I had two packed houses at a screening, and I'm looking at the audience, and they're crying one minute, they're smiling and literally cheering the next, and I'm like, that's sort of what I want to do. And the way the world is right now, to put something positive out there. So that's what I'd be looking to do. And you just never know what story is going to attract you. And I'm really particular on what I, because I know if I pick a documentary, it's minimum two years out of my life.
Right. It's got to be worth it.
Yeah. And I've got a short that I'm working on right now about a Harvard professor. His name is Steve Jarding. And I actually went to Harvard, and I went behind the scenes, got into the classrooms and filmed it. And he was in the Harvard Kennedy School, which is the political school named after John F. Kennedy at Harvard. And he was voted the Teacher of the Year in 2016, and then 2 years later, Harvard fires him without any reason. And sort of me talking to the students there, his students who he left his indelible mark on, and nobody can figure out why he was fired, and he doesn't know. So that's something I've already put together 22 minutes in that one. So that could be fascinating.
That's very neat. And they, it's something that could happen to anyone, job insecurity.
You never know. And it's just like at Harvard, a lot of people are asked to teach free at Harvard because the esteem that comes with that, you know,
yes. So
they don't even get paid. And then, but it's weird that Harvard has $40 billion in endowments. They don't need to charge tuition to these best of the best students that come in from all over the world. But it was interesting that I'm interviewing all these Harvard students and really the best of the best. I'm like, they're not that different than me, except they are. <It's> like, yeah, I talked to one guy and I said, so you chose Harvard? He goes, yeah, it was, you know, Oxford wanted me to. And I'm like, oh, that's a good problem to have. Oxford or Harvard, which one am I going to go to? And then I went to D.C. and I interviewed Senator Mark Warner, who was one of his students. And I got to go in the Capitol building, which was great. And I interviewed another, Steve Watkins, who is a congressman from Kansas. And this is his resume. He went to West Point, Harvard, MIT, climbed Mount Everest, and was the Iditarod sled race in Alaska.
Nice.
That's pretty interesting.
Totally. And
yeah,
so you find that a lot of these documentaries, half the time, they basically write themselves, but the material is interesting enough.
Yeah. And you gotta, you know, one of the hardest things is paring it down. With Jackie Stiles, I could do like a docu-series, like the, you know, the Michael Jordan docu-series, because there was so much material. And then you've got to cut down these great interviews that I love, but it's a pacing thing. So I got to put it in like 90 minutes. And that's one of the toughest things, is like what I don't get to use.
Right. Just all this material is like, well, I can maybe include it as like extended scenes on the DVD, but you know, I can't.
Well, I've done that. Yeah, I've done that whole extended scene stuff. Yeah, for sure. Because I go, well, I'll go with the edit. Like my very first film, I had a crane, and We the People had this big crane shot. And I go, and I'm working with the editor. The editor says, we need to cut that out. And I go, you're cutting out my crane shot that I shot at 3 o'clock in the morning when everybody's freezing? And he goes, it doesn't move the story. And I'm like, oh. And that was a tough one because we didn't have money for a crane. You know, it was my big production value shot.
Yeah, the ones like we kind of need it. Can we mix it in with like the opening credits?
Yeah, we got to put it in somehow because I paid for it.
Yeah. Are you my editor? Or are you
going beyond the back? Yeah, really. I thought you had my back.
Well, very neat. What are some closing thoughts like that you want to just give to just a few others who might be using Crowdfunder?
Well, you have to be passionate about it, because if you're not passionate about it, don't do it. If you want to be in this business, say of an actor to be famous, go do TikTok or something like that. It would be easier, because you won't last in this business unless you love it. And because it's too hard, there's too many down times, and it's too, you know, so you got to love what you do. And you always want to try to get better. And if you don't love what you do, you're dead in the water. So I always say, do what you need to do when you need to do it, even when you don't want to do it. And no excuses.
Nice.
That's the bottom line. No excuses. Go, you know, you go, well, I don't have the money to make a movie. Yeah, you do. I don't care if it's with your phone. You can go do it. But it's, you know, and you've got to be that driving force. And a lot of times it's the director who's the driving force, because they have to get it done. Because I've done a lot of things where I get people to work. We'll all work together, and we're all going to get paid together. It's what's the word I'm looking for? We work for free and then get money.
Totally.
Okay. I don't know. Anyway, but a lot of them, they'll quit on me, you know, and I go, okay, and I get it. You know, you're not getting paid, but deferred payment is what I'm looking for. Hello. I thought, we're all working for it. I said, I'm not getting paid. You're going to get the same amount of money that I'm going to get. And I go, I'm in. And then a month later, I'm out. You've got to be the one that just keeps on course and do it.
1,000%.
Yeah.
Well, thank you ever so much for a moment of your time. And
oh, you got it. Thanks, Cam, for having me. All the best.
Yeah. Just stay safe out there. And I mean, you got all this magnetic positivity. So
thank you. Well, I appreciate you reaching out.
1,000%. Keep spreading the joy.
All right, Cam. Have a good one.
Follow us on the web on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The podcast is available on Podbean, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Anchor, Apple, and anywhere else podcasts are available. Feel free to review our show and leave comments on any of those sites. Thanks a million for listening.
It's a Jacked Up Review Show. It's a Jacked Up Review Show. Jacked Up Review Show. It's a Jacked Up Review Show. It's a Jacked Up Review Show.